So what's the day today? The
23rd.
Okay. So it's a little after 11 a.m., April 23rd, and we're here at the headquarters of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York to interview Bill Halasy. Is that correct?
William Halasy, yes.
William. It's Scott Ganz and Bart DeZeeve from the FCIC, and if the other folks from the Federal Reserve could identify themselves for the record.
Kristen Stern, Federal Reserve.
Sherry Leventhal, Legal Group, Federal Reserve.
So, William, we're with the FCIC. I assume you're somewhat familiar with what we've been charged to do. It's a 10-member commission established by Congress. We're supposed to look at the near failures and failures of large financial institutions, investigate the causes of the financial crisis as a whole, and issue a report to the President and Congress on December 15th. This is an educational process for us. We're interviewing all sorts of folks. This isn't adversarial. I'm going to ask you questions. Obviously, if you don't understand or if Sherry thinks I haven't asked the question right, she'll interject. And the purpose here is for us to sort of get into your head and get your knowledge. So if you hear a question and you think there's actually a better question related to that topic, feel free to give me an answer not only to my question, but then explain why I've missed the boat and there's a better question that needs to be asked and answered.
Okay.
Since we are federal government creation, the same provisions of the Federal Criminal Code that apply to your work apply to our work. So if anyone attempts to mislead us, that's a federal crime under Title 18. And as you can see, we're recording this as well as you're recording this, so everything we have to say will be held for posterity.
Wonderful.
I've got a stack of documents here that I've organized chronologically, and so I'm just going to go through them and ask you questions as we go along, starting in 05, going through early 08.
Okay.
And if you need a break, just holler. And if the additional person who just walked in could identify.
Jennifer Schuster.
Thank you. Okay, so the first question I have is more of a procedural question, and these are three documents we've obtained from the OCC, and I'll identify them as a letter dated December 22, 2005 to Jeffrey Coley from Ronald Frake, which is a transmittal letter. A December 15th, 2005 examination findings, which were the basis of the transmittal letter, and then a response from Citigroup dated March 6, 2006 to Mr. Frake from Jeff Coley. And so this was an examination done in the fourth quarter of 2005. I guess my first question is, does the OCC share these sort of transmittal letters and examination reports on a regular basis with the Federal Reserve Bank staff?
They do, and my understanding is that anything that they produce, because we are the umbrella regulator, we can see their work because the bank is under the umbrella. But there is a regular sharing of information, you know, between the two. This particular exam, there was a lot of coordination on this exam with the Federal Reserve. We actually had a couple of examiners with them when they did this work.
Okay. So the first document, which is the December 22nd letter, and we'll just call that we'll mark it F1. Do you recall seeing that document before?
Yes.
Do you want to take a few minutes just to read the first two paragraphs of the letter?
I'm familiar with the findings of that. In a vague, I didn't review this particular letter recently, but I'm familiar with the findings.
Okay. So why don't you tell me, in your own words, what you think the findings of that examination were, if you're familiar with the findings.
Well, We did a similar review with the credit trading group in this is a review of the credit trading group broadly in New York. We did a subsequent review of the London operations of the same business. So we thought of these as sort of almost a joint exam. Whether that's the official designation or not, I don't know. But we were doing them. We shared our findings. The findings were actually quite similar across both. The business was growing rapidly, and the infrastructure was not sufficient to keep pace with that growth.
And by infrastructure, what do you mean?
The systems that were used to book the transactions, their ability to price the transactions, their ability to measure risk in the transactions was what we would have called not satisfactory.
And were they using a simple spreadsheet at that time, or do you recall how they were?
It was a mix of spreadsheets and systems, but as the business evolved and the instruments evolved, the systems, we always look dimly on spreadsheets for large businesses, but the systems that they did have in place were sort of becoming obsolete as the transactions sort of changed, the characteristics of the transaction change, and just the whole process, including the people, wasn't sufficient for the volume that was actually being transacted.
And so, in 2005, early 2006, you had quite a bit of interaction with Mr. Frake during the examination. Is that accurate?
Yes. I mean, we would have coordinated with Ron on this. You know, I've had a lot of interaction with Ron over the years.
And is that also part of the, is it called continuous monitoring, or is that?
Part of our, we do continuous monitoring. We do a lot of it jointly. You know, we attend a lot of the same meetings. You know, we don't want to have repetitive meetings with the people that we're meeting with, so we do them jointly. In particular, the market risk, the area that I've always been involved in with Citibank.
Bart, I don't mean to interrupt. Would it be helpful if Bill gave you a little sense of how the exam process works?
Sure.
I'll step back one step even beyond that. Do you understand how bank supervision is the risk relationship sort of matrix? There's
the camel and the other.
No. He's talking about how we're
organized and how we approach examining banks. There's essentially two groups within this matrix, what we call the relationship side, which actually is responsible for individual banks, their ultimate assessment, you know, contact with management, and all that has to do with a specific institution. And then there's the risk side, which brings in the expertise in certain areas, be it market risk areas like this, credit, operations, whatever. These are the people that, the risk side, that mostly conduct the examinations. Okay, the OCC structure just broadly is set up differently, where they have their entire team devoted to the bank all the time. So we have a slightly different structure than they do. In the context of what I was doing here, I was on the risk side, so I was actually brought in by the CPC team, our CPC team,
CPC is central point of contact.
The relationship side, our CPC team, because there was a concern about what was going on in this business. There seems to be a similar concern at the OCC. They use their in-house examiners. So in this context, what we're talking about here, I wasn't strictly doing continuous monitoring. We were actually assigned to do an examination because the on-site team, our relationship folks, had identified issues that needed to be looked at closer.
And so did you switch at some point from being on the risk side and move over to the CPC?
I did.
Roughly what time was that?
It was the last week of 2006.
Okay. The next group of documents are a couple of Federal Reserve documents, Bates numbered 32-34 and 27-29. These are compliance with examiner worksheets, Citigroup written agreement review dated June 2005. If you want to just take a look at those, one is with respect to puts on super senior CDO tranches. The other is with respect to Brera CDO 1.
I am familiar with the underlying material that this is actually referencing. I am not familiar with this actual worksheet. I know of the work that the examiners are doing. I can't speak to it that much, but I understand what they're actually looking at here.
So this is, as I understand it, and I'm going to mark these F4 and F5. As I understand it, this looks to be work that was done from the sort of compliance with the formal agreement that was put in place post-Enron and not necessarily sort of a credit type of analysis.
Is that seems to be the case,
characterization?
Yes.
So in reading the sort of summary, you understand the transactions, but these documents would not have come through your channel back then.
That's correct. I didn't have any engagement with the firm at this point, and if I was actually looking at these transactions, I probably would not necessarily have requested this sort of compliance assessment of the business.
So
the person for those documents,
right,
you know, is barred.
Right.
Have
so I assumed that was. I just wanted to make sure.
No, I know. I'm just.
So the next document, which I will mark as F6 and is Bates numbered 680 and 681, is a two-page memo dated August 18, 2005, titled CDO ABS Warehouse Business.
I'm familiar with this document, and I'm almost 100% certain that this document was put together in relation to what we called a liquids horizontal. Do you understand our horizontal reviews?
I believe I do, but go ahead and...
We do a review across multiple institutions. A lot of times it takes place across all the largest, in this case, all the largest capital markets firm. The point of this was to find out industry-wide how well banks were valuing illiquid, hard-to-value securities and what kind of controls they had around the process. So when they are actually talking about the CDO ABS warehouse business, they actually would have actually taken a transaction and they would have used that transaction as a sample to test the valuation processes.
So was this the sort of memo that would have been going to you as part of that horizontal review? Are these people on your...
Roseanne and Laura, I know them all.
Yeah.
actually, I was part of this horizontal review. I did not do work at Citibank, so I am actually familiar with what we were trying to do. The way these horizontal review would work is in some ways is similar to a regular exam. The on-site team would take the findings of these reviews and use it to assess the firm. Right, so in this case, I think in this case, Citi actually came out quite favorably in this review. They had good controls and good pricing processes around a lot of these instruments. The on-site team, when they rolled up their assessment of Citigroup, would incorporate those findings into their overall assessment.
Okay. If you could take a moment and read the first paragraph under the heading Risk Management.
I've seen this before, but I just don't have it. Should have brought that idea.
Okay.
So, it says here that market risk does not measure VAR, which I assume means value at risk, for the warehouse assets. Market risk assigned market value and credit spread 0.01 limits for the X warehouse positions, primary and secondary, based on external credit rating buckets. Putting that into English, does that mean that, for example, the AAA-rated super senior tranches of CDOs that are being warehoused before they're sold are not assigned a market risk component because they're intended just to be held temporarily? Is that what that means?
Almost. When they're building the CDO, they bring these assets on and put them in a warehouse.
Right.
The individual assets were not measured in the firm's value at risk measure. They were, I guess, not considered part of their overall trading book.
So that would be like the triple B rated MBS subprime securities that are being purchased and warehoused and then eventually packaged into the CDO.
Right.
So, okay.
Right. Or at this time, these could have been other things too. They could have been corporate bonds and stuff, credit card securitizations, just a portfolio of bonds. They were measuring some of the risk on it. The spread risk is just how sensitive it is to market changes. So there was some measurement of risk of that inventory.
Okay. So looking again at that second sentence where it says based on external credit rating buckets. So when it's being warehoused, it's a triple B rated MBS subprime residential mortgage security. And then when it comes out the other side, it's going to be a triple A super senior CDO tranche that they put into these special purpose entities, as I understand it. So when it says based on external credit rating buckets, do you know which rating that refers to? Does that refer to the underlying MBS or the...
Because they're talking about the warehouse, they're talking about the underlying securities. So the warehouse full of ABS and whatever other types of bonds they were holding in there. What they would do is they would if I understand this correctly, they would take the rating of the individual bond, because it's very hard to get data on individual bonds, and they would look at all other bonds rated similarly, and they would say, well, you know, this has a credit spread sensitivity of X, and this segment of the market, all these triple Bs, move so much, so I can sort of construct a little like stressed risk analysis of that particular part of the portfolio.
Okay. Thank you. So the next document, F7, is product memo for the discovery review of Citigroup's complex and illiquid products, beginning with base number 550, ending with 573. For your information, Sherry, in the actual production, page 2 is blank, and so we had 550A.
Okay. Yeah, we didn't produce these. The
right,
board did.
Right. So, and I've got a spare copy of page 2 in my briefcase. I'll give it to you afterwards just so you have it as well. Do you want to take just a few seconds and take a look at that?
Well, unless you want to ask me about the conclusions, I'm familiar with this. This is, I guess, a roll-up of all the work done at Citigroup as part of this horizontal. That memo would have either been incorporated wholly or partly, or the thoughts that conveyed in that memo would have been incorporated into this. So that looks like some of the exam work that fed this.
Okay. So at this point, you were in the risk side.
Correct.
So does that mean that you weren't working on this? I mean, did you actually draft pieces of this?
No.
Okay.
I noticed one thing, just, you know, off the right for a moment. I know Kathy Boyce appears on a number of these documents. She's not here
right.
any longer, but we can reach out to her.
Okay.
If we get, obviously we'll have to be a little accommodating of her schedule because she's at a private bank, but
we
can do the best we can there.
Okay.
Her husband still works here, so, so we know how to reach her.
All right. Marking as F8, a letter from the Federal Reserve Bank dated September 23rd, 2005, begins with base number 42 and goes to 44.
I didn't participate on this. This, again, has to do with the written agreement. The documents with Greg Garr's name on it would seem to be related to that, but I wasn't involved.
Right. All right. The next document, which I'll mark F8.
F9.
Oops.
F9.
F9. F9. Thanks. Is bait stamped 667 to 673, and I believe they are a summary of some OCC findings by an examiner whose last name is Vervoulis.
Vervoulis, yes.
And it involves an examination of the London correlation book. If you can take just a second to take a look at that to see.
Okay. If you want me to look at the conclusions, I can read it, but if not, I do know what this document is from. As I said, there were two exams, one conducted in the U.S. by the OCC. That was the October, and you have the letters. Those are the first
right.
documents. And subsequent to that, they almost overlapped. We did the London operations. This is from the London operations. I forget her first name, but Ms. Vervoulis was an OCC participant on a Fed-led exam of the London operations. So this memo would have been just her contribution to our final write-up.
Okay. Turning to what appears to be the fourth page, but unfortunately it's not numbered. Can you just read to yourself the portion in bold?
Yeah, I think this is, again, consistent with our overall conclusions with that business and consistent with what the OCC found in New York, that, it again, the business had outgrown its infrastructure and their ability to control it properly.
Okay. So as you saw before, Ron Frake sent some letters to Citibank from the OCC based on this work and the other exams that had been done. And I'll characterize his statement that essentially, you know, there were findings that there were problems, as you've just stated. But then in March 2006, Citigroup, Citibank, basically had told the OCC, yes, we understand there have been problems, but we are going to address them. We're going to have internal controls that will measure risk, and we will have independent risk managers who will enforce those internal controls. And essentially, in the first Ron Frake letter I showed you, there was an implicit or explicit threat that they would put on a binding enforcement action limiting the amount of business they could do. And he said that the reason they didn't do that was in March 2006, the officials at Citibank basically said, we get the message, we understand, your concerns are legitimate, and we're going to address them. Of course, subsequently, when they went back the next time after the events of the fall of 07, they in fact found that risk limits had been increased dramatically, not only in the CDO book, but also in the leveraged loan pipeline as well, and that risk management, in the words of the OCC, had essentially caved in to the business folks every time that there was a desire to raise revenue. Given that is sort of my characterization of the OCC's view, can you tell me what your view is, if you had one at the time, of what Citigroup's response was to the concerns that were being expressed both by the OCC and the Fed on the infrastructure capabilities and other problems inherent in the CDO desk business?
I think my assessment would be quite consistent with what you, the way you characterize Ron's assessment. The only thing that I would add to that is that, you know, this was a business that they really, really wanted to be in. They really wanted to grow. They thought it was a profitable business. But they did take our findings seriously. In general, they would take our findings very seriously, particularly if they come from both the OCC and the Fed. They're telling you need to fix this. And I believe that they were actually, they did have a lot of fixes in the pipeline. They probably grew faster than we eventually would have liked them to. But I think that they were putting the fixes in place and that the fixes were real.
So the next document, F-10, is bait stamp number 663 through 666, and it's dated November 1, 2005. And it said it's the minutes of a meeting to discuss the ABS CDO business as part of Citibank European Structured Credit Derivatives Target Exam.
Yeah, this was prepared by Mark, who was working for me on that exam. This is like Mr. Vervulius's memo. This is more or less his conclusions for his responsibility on the exam, which would have been rolled up into the final product memo, the final conclusion memo.
Thank you. if you could read just that last paragraph on the first page. So, as I read that, the last couple sentences, now almost all new underlyings are coming out of the U.S., mostly subprime mortgages, with 80% of that business in MBS and the rest in CMBS. As I understand that sentence, it says that the CDO business, is, at least with respect to this desk, is now focused on taking subprime MBS and packaging them up as CDOs, is that?
That's correct. That's correct. The business migrated from, you know, having a more diversified portfolio to basically relying on the subprime for its inventory.
And did, at the time, did you have any concerns about sort of the underlying, the nature of the underlying assets that were being used in the CDO business as they were going from sort of the corporate credit CDO, CLO book to the subprime?
Well, there, I mean, you know, there were general concerns, you know, that I was aware of with, you know, the subprime market. This is in late 2005. You know, it didn't become a real issue at that time. I mean, we understood that, you know, subprime mortgages were, you know, of a lesser quality. But when this business runs as it should be, most of this is actually supplying this stuff to customers that are actually asking for it. So it's in a lot of cases, the structures are actually put together upon customer requests. So maybe we had deluded ourselves a little bit, but this stuff was moving through a pipeline rather quickly.
Now, as I understand the CDO business, at least with respect to cash CDOs versus synthetic CDOs, is that they would acquire, as you've described it, and put in a warehouse the MBS pieces, and then this facility would be created, a special purpose entity that would technically issue the CDO, and that in all the instances that I'm aware of in looking at the records, that the so-called super senior AAA rated tranche of the CDO, it either stayed in the entity, which then financed itself with asset-backed commercial paper where Citibank issued a put, and so that the super senior piece never sort of made it beyond the entity, and it was retained by the SPE as opposed to the mezzanine and other pieces, which there was a lot of active demand, but there wasn't, as I understand it, very much investor demand for the super senior AAA piece because the yield spread was so narrow, and so they couldn't profitably market those pieces. Is that a...
That's
accurate description.
Yes, that's it. It wasn't supposed to actually work that way. I guess theoretically there would be demand for all the tranches, and there was extraordinary demand for the lower pieces, and that's what these businesses were feeding. That's what was driving these businesses. So the riskiest pieces, they had demand before they even actually packaged these. As I said, they actually packaged these with investor requests, were used to actually structure these. So there was demand for these underlying subprime mortgages. Unfortunately, the way that it was structured, they were moving that stuff out the door, and as you said, there wasn't really any demand for the senior piece. It didn't return anything. It was seen as low risk, so it was actually warehoused until they could figure out how to fund it or otherwise dispose of it.
And in our conversations with the OCC, they said that they were not aware of any of those super senior pieces ever being independently sold to third parties.
I don't know if that's... they said they're not aware of it. I can't actually point to one, but I don't think they had on their books every single super senior piece that they ever created. But I don't remember actually.
And just to narrow the scope, that was just with respect to the subprime MBS CDOs, not all CDOs.
Right. Okay. Right. Right. I mean, it could be the case. This stuff was moving out the door rather quickly. It was a priority to get the lower tranches out because they were seeing where the risk was. So that the focus was to get these things out the door, not to hold them or to hedge those lower pieces.
One of the other things we learned in talking to the OCC was that the structure of using an SPE to issue asset-backed commercial paper supported by a liquidity put from the bank was used until a treasury group, I'm not sure if it was at Citigroup or Citibank, but put a limit on the amount of the liquidity puts that could be issued. They originally, I think it was $23 billion, but eventually capped out at $25 billion. And then they said, well, that's it for, you know, the liquidity put business. You can't issue any more liquidity puts on CDOs backed by subprime mortgage-backed securities. We don't want the liquidity risk associated with that. So then, from that point in time, the business, as I understand it, migrated to sort of a split book between the cash CDO business and the synthetic CDO business, where the synthetic CDOs created through the use of credit default swaps were booked at the National Bank, and the cash CDO business was booked on the broker-dealer or one of the other non-bank subs. Is that also your general understanding of?
Yes. The cause and effect of the liquidity put limits, I don't actually really recall. I do know that it ended up in like three distinct spots. One being the liquidity puts was the real end risk, and then the other two pieces, the synthetic and the other cash business.
So back in that time, do you recall looking at the liquidity puts as a source of potential credit concern during any of your work?
No, we actually, the way that we actually looked at it, we almost thought of the liquidity put as sort of equivalent to actually holding the asset-backed. It was contingent risk, and the maximum amount of that contingent risk was the maximum amount of the piece underlying the super senior. So when I looked at those positions, I just thought of them as being actually economically equivalent. Whereas if you were only looking at the bank, then you'd want to make that distinction because the risk only comes to the bank if the liquidity put is exercised. But in my mind, since we were looking at the overall structure, I just saw them as being actually economically equivalent, which I think that's what they ended up being.
Okay. So what are we on now, F11? So F11 is a document beginning with Bates stamp 674 going through 679, dated November 28th, 2005, a target exam section, market risk management.
What this appears to be is another document, the same as Mark Sexton's and Ms. Vervulius's, that is actually feeding the European credit derivatives exam. So these would just been whoever was
different pieces.
Just looking at the market risk management piece would have produced this memo to actually feed the final conclusion. Generally, when we go out into the field, and you can see for the final product conclusion memo, there's about, I don't know, there was like five or six of us on there. Each person would have been, the responsibility would have been divvied up in different areas. So that's what some of these memos are actually doing. They're concluding what an individual person was responsible for. So in this memo right here, the person would not have been looking so much at positions or anything, but the actual abilities of the systems and the people to measure risk.
So this is sort of a risk measurement report on their systems?
Right. What the systems are capable of doing, what their weaknesses are, and so on and so forth.
Okay. All right. F12, again, is related to these prior documents, begins with base stamp 631 and goes through 662, dated December 2005. It's a product memorandum from you and a bunch of other folks. Related to the European credit derivatives examination.
Yes, and this is the conclusions of the overall examination in London. And the general conclusion here was that a lot of the control systems around this business were either inadequate for the size of the business or they were just not functioning properly.
Okay, I'd like to turn to page 13. Which is base stamp 643. And if you could just read the section starting ABS CDO on that page to where the next section starts on page 14.
Okay.
So, if you can explain what these bottom two sentences on page 13, the major risk position the desk is carrying is in the triple B tranche, where they are running a large short in ABS, largely with home equity loan underlyings. They're also running a long position in AAA tranches against this. Can you explain those two sentences?
Yeah, the this is these are synthetics. When you tranche the security up, you sort of have, you know, people are actually taking different levels of risk. The super senior being at the top. What they're actually talking about here is the pieces underlying that. That's where the real demand and the real flow, as I explained further, that's where the real back and forth trading took place. And to be honest with you, that is what we were actually concerned with when we did these exams, because that gets actually very complex. when you tranche these things up, there's somebody who takes what's called the equity piece, and then in between that, the mezzanine tranches, and they have various names, but it gets very complex. You know, who's going to take what losses, and what does that mean for you to actually value these risk managers, how you construct a hedge that's going to perform adequately against that. So without sitting here and scratching my head too much, what this is actually talking about is that it looked like the book was a little bit unbalanced, where they had they were long in one tranche and short in another tranche, and those somewhat offset each other, but they don't necessarily have to actually perform in an offset manner. So when he says the major risk position here. This is actually, I think, takes from Mark's memo, because this language sounds consistent. You know, generally, that's how we put these things together.
Right.
What he was probably meant by this is that if he looked at the risk positions that they reported, he's probably saying the biggest risk of all that gets left on their books after all this trading is this. That doesn't necessarily mean that it was overly large when he was looking at it, right? He's saying if you conduct this business the way they're conducting it, what they're actually will end up holding.
So when he's referring to the triple B tranches, is he talking about the CDO tranches there, or is he talking about the underlying MBS?
I'm pretty sure he's talking about the CDO itself, and they are also running a long position in the AAA tranches. So actually, here again, you see where they're actually holding the top of the structure in inventory, but the short against it, or what they haven't been able to move yet, appears to be the BBB slice of it.
And if you could, on page 14, read the first four paragraphs under structured financing and exotic CDS.
Okay.
In the third paragraph, it says, repackaging places assets in an SPV and issues notes to investors that are not authorized to transact derivatives. The reference credits are generally customized to suit an investor's needs. And the deals are structured to receive external ratings that meet the investor's requirements. So is that referring to the sort of synthetic CDOs? Or is that?
No, actually, that is specifically not referring to synthetic CDOs. You know, and a lot of investors, you know, their investment mandates, they're not authorized to take positions in derivatives, but they want to take exposure to, say, credit risky assets. They have to do it in some sort of cash note form. You can actually put these into an SPV and then write a note where the investor actually gets that exposure in a cash form. So that's one way of actually not doing the derivative. In many of these cases, the derivative is economically equivalent of some underlying note or a pool of bonds. But you know, the investment mandates say you can't do derivatives. So to get that, you would put it into an SPV and write a note on it. And then what else does it say here? The reference credits are generally customized to suit the investor's needs. As I said, a lot of the structuring that went on, even in the ABS CDO business, in many of these businesses, the structures were put together because the investors were asking for the bank to do these. So these customers came and said, you know, I'd like a pool of credits that looks like this. The underlyings are asset backs or corporate bonds or whatever. And again, they're structured to receive the external ratings to meet the investor's requirement. So what that would mean is that if you knew that the ratings criteria would say, okay, if and I'm making this very simple, but you could take a pool of double B bonds, put them into a CDO, structured so that somebody took the first losses, then the remaining would be safe enough to be rated AA, AAA, or whatever you wanted. So, you know, they knew the investor was looking for some exposure to a certain market. They couldn't take a derivatives position, and it had to be something investment grade or better. So the structure was set up that way. And that statement, in some form or another, could apply to many, many parts of the CDO business. Not just here, but the industry. That's the way the industry was run.
Okay, if we can go back then to page 2, which is bait stamp 632. And if you could read the bolded section there.
I actually recently reread these conclusions.
Okay.
So go ahead. I think I can.
All right. So the bold section says, as a result, management acknowledged, one, the need to bring infrastructure to industry standards. So as I read that, it says the infrastructure was below industry standards. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, the way we use that term, it really wasn't up to the standard that you would expect of any trading business doing something. I don't know if I have an exact benchmark of what industry standards were, but it was it was subpar. It was unsatisfactory.
So you had done a horizontal review. You'd looked at other large institutions at that
point?
No,
not a formal horizontal, but the one thing about, as I explained, the risk relationship sort of dynamic and me being in risk is the fact that I would have been on many other exams, and
okay.
Not just in credit derivatives, but across the spectrum of capital markets. So there's certain standards that you're actually looking for. You know, can you book these things properly? Do they feed the books and records properly? Can you price them properly? Do you have limits? Can you monitor those limits? Well, so forth. This whole suite of controls. So that may be a loose term of industry. You know, there isn't like a benchmark for credit derivatives, but there is a standard that we expect people, a general standard for trading activities that could be sort of translated into this specific business. So if you're doing something this complex, you would need a certain set of controls and sort of quality to those controls.
Right. So point number 2, quote, the need for a fully controlled environment, close quote.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to me what you meant?
Yeah, I mean there were a lot of issues there. I mean, one of the simple ones that comes to mind is that a lot of these trades, particularly the ones that reference corporate bonds, have hundreds of names underneath them, and they were putting these together really fast, and there was countless errors in the way that they actually recorded the names in their books and records system. So, I mean, it seems very, very simple, but you know, they just didn't have a process in place to actually capture that and reconcile the names with, you know, what the underlyings were and things like that. Again, it was the business was moving much quicker than the infrastructure that it put systems and people could actually handle.
And then the next sentence, or the next clause, which would be three, says, quote, the need to reduce operational risk, close quote. Can you explain that clause? I
mean? Well, that clause would be, the example that I just gave you would be, you know, would be an example of operational risk. So we weren't saying that you need to bring down the market risk, or credit risk, however you want to think of the economic risk in it. We weren't saying to them, like, you need to bring these positions down because we think it's risky. What we were saying is that you need to, you know, have sufficient resources in place so that all these mistakes weren't being made. I mean, at the extreme, you could lose sight of how much inventory you had or something like that. You know, so to reduce operational risk would be, you know, to put those controls in place and stop making so many mistakes.
Okay. So stepping back and looking at this from the sort of a big picture perspective, as we've discussed, when they were using the liquidity puts, they moved a lot of the CDO pieces into the special purpose entities or mm-hmm. vehicles off the balance sheet. And my understanding is that when those assets go off the balance sheet, that reduces Citigroup's requirement to hold capital against them? Is that...
In most cases, yeah. I won't say specifically this one, but yes, most likely.
Now, is that an area within sort of your purview in this type of an examination, or is capital adequacy in looking at a structure, is that like compliance? That's someone else's job to determine whether or not the risks inherent in this thing possibly bouncing back into Citigroup's balance sheet is being addressed?
Yeah, it could be. Capital adequacy could be. In general, when we do these reviews, it was not, because there's a separate process that we look at capital, how they do capital for their credit risk, such as loans, the market risk, and so on, so forth. In most of these kind of reviews, and you know, I've done many, many market risk reviews, the risk is not, we're not there to measure the most extreme risk, right? We're actually looking closely at the controls. And even if you say in many of these businesses that something disastrous would happen, there would be a real adverse market movement, you wouldn't normally, unless you made the assessment, you wouldn't normally be thinking of it as an event that would use up the firm's capital. I mean, they had suffered losses in this business, partly due to infrastructure weaknesses and some market turmoil in 2005, earlier this year, before this was done. And the losses were, I think they might have been $50 million. In the grand scheme of things, for a place the size of Citibank, all that really is to them is it's an income event, not a capital event. So yes, I mean, if we had made the assessment that this is something that could take down the bank, you would certainly, you would bring in capital. Actually, if it was something you thought was where the bank's capital at risk, you might have taken extremely severe actions against the bank. But we did not assess it that way.
So, looking at the next paragraph below the one in bold, the sentence talks about senior management being made aware, and the final sentence of that paragraph says, while appropriate actions were undertaken to initiate improvements to the infrastructure, it appears that there was an oversight gap in delegating authority slash responsibility to the businesses for monitoring and deciding, if necessary, to curtail growth.
Yeah. Early on, their internal auditors had identified this these issues, and the internal audit in many organizations, but particularly at Citi, the internal auditors don't just make a blanket statement and whatever they say goes. They work out solutions and things with the business, and their workout with the business in this case, this was done, I think, earlier in 2005, was that the business would curtail their growth, you know, stay sort of at an even keel till all these things were fixed. But what it, and I guess it was the assumption of the internal auditors that risk managers would monitor the volume and size of this. But the conclusion that we drew, and I think internal audit drew here too, was after they negotiated that settlement with the business, it was really the business who made the call whether they were allowed to start growing again. And in this case, the business said, "Well, we've got enough fixed now that we can go forward and grow." So there was a earlier period of some difficulty. The audit went in; they did those findings. The business began to fix things, but then they started to grow again. And then when we came in there, an internal audit was in at the same time frame that we were in late 2005. We again said to them, "No, this business is it's still broken. You need major fixes need to be done here."
So going down to the skipping two paragraphs, issue deficiencies in market risk management's ability to monitor the risks in the correlation book were identified in the infrastructure review and highlighted during the credit market events of 2Q. Close quote. What does correlation book mean, and what does that sentence in general refer to?
This was the derivative book, and it was a very, very highly technical issue that that made it difficult for them to actually value certain intermediate tranches in there, particularly the mezzanine tranche. There was enough dislocation, I think it was around some problems at Ford and General Motors. The credit markets became sort of unbalanced. There were large moves, and it became very difficult for them to actually price I think they went for a period of time without being able to do accurate prices on this one portion of the book, the middle mezzanine tranches. This is somewhat a little bit different than the infrastructure review because I think many other firms had this issue.
Do you need a break,
by
any chance?
No.
You okay?
Okay. Do I look like
a
need one?
No, but
you look great.
I told Kristen if she needs to take one, she can.
Oh, okay.
So, was this document actually made in December 2005, or is that an as-of date, and it's like an exam report, and it might have been made in January or February? Do you have a recollection?
This would have been, we generally assign ourselves a week to write these things up after the exam. In all likelihood, it usually takes a couple of weeks because we bounce things back and forth. We do a lot of editing here,
right,
to make sure the language is correct, even though you noticed there was a couple typos in there. But soon thereafter, it may have been the first week of January. You know, the holidays come up. We were all out of town and stuff like that. But, I mean, it's close. It wasn't produced in May
right.
of 2006.
Right. Okay. So what was your overall sense of the message that this memorandum was conveying? Were you saying that there were some problems, where you're saying there were significant problems, they are being addressed, they aren't being addressed, just sort of a general overview. What sense were you trying to convey with your team by this memorandum?
There were significant problems. If you go through all of the controls, there were numerous problems in many different areas of controls here. What we found when we were on site were plans that were in progress. You know, some had future completion dates, some were in the process of being completed, to actually address most of what was identified here. You have to remember that, as I said before, issues were identified earlier due to market dislocations and earlier internal audit reports. You know, the on-site relationship team would have looked at those. Actually, that's one of the reasons why they scheduled this exam. So the fact that we went in and looked at this like with a fine-tooth comb at this point, we had already been working on this. You know, we planned before we went there. We got as much documentation. We had had meetings with them ahead of time. So, before we even got there, we had a good sense of already where this was going to go. And we also had a good sense of what they were already doing. You know, a lot of these fixes, may take months or years to actually put in place. So a lot of the project plans were in place. Some things had been addressed. Systems were coming on that better addressed, certain sectors of the business and stuff like that. So the conclusion was that, there were still a lot of issues here that needed to be addressed, but I don't know if it conveys it properly here, but we did find serious efforts at the bank to address those. I mean, the bank would have known that we took these issues seriously, the fact that we scheduled the exam, and the OCC had scheduled the exam, and we had had a lot of meetings with them. So there was some progress being made.
So this is a internal memorandum, correct?
That mm-hmm. the federal right. We don't give these to the bank. Or
okay. So, going to F13. This is an examination report dated as of December 31st, 2005, transmitted to the Board of Directors of Citigroup, April 10th, 2006, and goes from bait stamp 87619. To 87637. So, as I understand it, this is your basic examination report that goes to the institution. Is that
this? And you probably are best to get the details on this from Diane. Or other senior people who
right.
had the central point of contact is the person who runs the relationship team. If there's a team, what this appears to be is the roll up of all the work and all the assessments that were done over a period of time. I assume a year over the course of say 2005, and it would have incorporated my work and all the other work that was done there, plus the continuous monitoring efforts by the on-site relationship team.
Okay.
So I think you're pointing to this.
Right. So then we turn to page A2, which is 87637. And up the top, it's got a bold heading that says Credit Derivatives, London/New York. And then it's got a couple of sentences. The exam focused on the key infrastructure limitations that had been identified by management with respect to the firm's single name and correlation trading activities in the GCM businesses. In addition, examiners reviewed the risk profiles of the credit trading, structured credit products, and emerging markets businesses. So it makes a reference to the supervisory activity in this appendix, but it doesn't sort of convey sort of it says what the topic was, but it doesn't give like a high, medium, or low grade, or doesn't say, you know, we found problems or we didn't find problems. Is that sort of typical, as far as you know?
I can't really speak to how these. I've never actually personally done one of these. This is the CPC's job, so I'm not sure how those are actually put together.
Okay.
I will say though that that the findings of the examination are conveyed to, you know, senior levels, because I remember having the conversation at the conclusion of that exam with, you know, the most senior risk managers, the most senior business.
Would that have been Dave Bushnell, or do you remember?
I'm not sure if Dave Bushnell would have actually was actually
B.B.
on
Duke?
The call. Probably B.B. Duke. Probably B.B. Duke. At least to that level. And all the risk managers who worked under her.
Right.
The business, the people,
Murray
all the
Barnes.
Way up the chain. Murray Barnes. Of course, Murray was doing the New York piece, so he would have been conveyed the OCC's thing. But, you know, people equivalent to him and on up the risk management chain, as well as the people who run that business. So all the way up, I guess, to the level of Coley. I'm almost positive he was on that on the phone call when we conveyed, you know, what it was we were looking at, what it was we expected them to do about it.
So in the parlance that I'm familiar with, at the end of an exam, it's called a closing meeting.
Close out. That's yes, exactly.
So, you're saying there was a closeout meeting, and it was by a telephone conference.
Yes, it was by a telephone conference because several of the people were in London.
Okay.
So it probably took place, in the first couple of weeks of January.
And would there typically be minutes for a closeout meeting, or is that something where you?
No, not often, because basically what you're trying to do is trying to convey those conclusions as closely as you've actually written them there.
So referring back to F-12,
the product memo.
The product memo. You basically orally convey the highlights of this memo during the closeout?
Yeah. You know, when we put those together, one of the reasons we do a lot of editing is you want to get the message correct, right? And once you've gotten that and we've got a lot of people to agree on this is the message we want, it conveys what we want to say to them, you don't want to ad-lib it when you get in front of them.
Right.
So you give them that message. So, yes, they would have been aware of that. And to be quite honest with you, many of the senior people probably dialed in during the exam for some sake and for maybe this. So it was communicated.
Okay. So we'll leave behind that exam and go on to what I believe was a horizontal review. Not sure you had any involvement here.
No, I don't think so. I think this might be...
So just to identify it for the record, it begins with Bates stamp 436 and goes to Bates stamp 517, and it's horizontal review stress testing Citigroup March 20th to April 7th, 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So, did you participate in this horizontal review at all? Do you recall?
No.
Okay.
Actually, what was the date on it?
March 20th to April
7th. No.
So the next document is F-15, starts with Bates stamp 378, goes through Bates stamp 435, and it's titled Roll-Up Presentation 2006, Citigroup, Inc. Why don't you start
with just sort of a general description, what is a roll-up presentation that the Federal Reserve Bank does for bank holding companies?
It's an overall view of basically the condition of the firm, as well as the actual roll-up of all our knowledge of the controls on the firm. This is actually presented to the LFIT, which is like the large financial institutions team. So this is actually going to the group that oversees the largest banks that we supervise.
So this is an internal presentation?
This is an internal presentation. It is the sum of all our knowledge and all our work over the course of the year, and it's done on an annual basis.
So can you point me to the provisions of this agreement that you would have had input on, looking at the table of contents?
It's not an agreement.
The written
did
agreement?
I say agreement? Yeah. No. this document, what portions did you have input on?
There's certain sections that are divided up by risk bucket. I would have been market and liquidity risk, so I would have actually been responsible for those. I will tell you that at this point in time, I had moved from the risk side to the relationship side, but I had only started in the last week of 2006. So really, I had very little contribution. You know, I was leveraging off of what the prior market risk coordinator would have actually put together. It was actually Kathy. She was actually promoted to the deputy CPC at the time. But the section that I would have, unless anything that I did made it to the items of interest, I think there was a lot of focus on compliance issues. You would actually really have to go down to the part where we begin stratifying risk. Analysis of risk management. So I would have had, or a person in my position would have had responsibility for giving these ratings.
And just for the record, that's Bates number page 406, where various risk management ratings are indicated, including one for market and liquidity.
Mm-hmm. In this year, they actually started out with the legal and compliance area. That there was a lot more focus on that because the firm had issues in the past. There, and you can just go through to you get to the section on market risk. I was almost there. And there's probably several other pages here that I would have actually done this liquidity risk section too.
Beginning on page 46. In this
page
number.
46. Interest rate risk also was under my purview. These are all the main talking points. This would have been where we actually got our ratings in the individual control areas.
So you came over to the CPC side when? the
It was the last week in December.
Of 2006. Okay.
So they were rolling up their thoughts for 2006 when I got there. So, you know, I did participate in it, but my input to it was minimal.
Okay. So the next document that I'm numbering F16 is a Citigroup document, and the Bates numbers are 518 through 549. And I'll just characterize it as a sort of some sort of summary or presentation of structured products business at Citigroup. So why don't you take a look at just the first few pages and see if this is a document with which you have any familiarity?
Yes, I'm probably the one that actually put this in our databases where it was probably extracted from. There's a cover page to this. It doesn't really matter. It just has a title, Market Risk Management Report of Credit Trading Business or something like that.
Okay.
And it's an overview of all of the credit trading, everything that's in sort of the credit trading silo within the investment bank.
And sort of looking at the dates, I'm looking at page 24, just looking at some of the dates, it appears this document would have been created sometime around December of 2006 or shortly around then, since the latest date referenced is November 2006.
Yeah, that's correct. This document was, they had traditionally put these together on a semi-annual basis to report to senior market risk and senior business folks about, you know, what's going on in the business.
So turning to page 24, US CDO key market risk exposures X warehouse. Looking at the third bullet point, net super senior exposure grew from $29 billion to $31 billion over the period. Super senior exposure is now reported on both the gross and net basis, with the gross amount excluding market spread volatility hedges, including CDS and LSS notes. So, so the exposure, I take it, where it says super senior exposure, it's talking about the AAA rated super senior tranches of the CDOs.
Yes,
do you know? Do you know? Do you have a recollection of what that was referring to? Do you know, was it items that were on the books of Citigroup? Was it items that were on the books of Citigroup combined with things in the special purpose entities?
This would have been positions. The way these are reported here, they had sometimes, again, they had sort of mixed together the liquidity puts and the cash positions, but this is probably mostly referring to the cash positions at that time.
So in December of 2006 or thereabouts when this document came to your attention, did you have any reaction where you saw that the super senior exposure was growing and it was around $30 billion, or was that not something that caused you a great degree of concern?
I remember actually having the conversation with folks. You know, this was actually, we went in for quarterly continuous monitoring meetings to talk with these folks, and about, since they did 6 month reviews, half of those quarterly meetings involved this report. So if we were given this report, we could ask any questions about it. My OCC colleagues were there with me. Yes, we had conversations. It's a big number. Big numbers always get your attention. But, you know, these positions are, you know, whatever underlies them aside, these positions were seen as very, very safe instruments. So, you know, we did have the discussions. It would have been preferable for us to, that the bank actually dispose of these. It's a basically a really bad use of the balance sheet to have it just held up by these low-performing assets, big low-performing assets that need to be funded and stuff like that. But no, were we shocked? You know, did we, you know, did it set off alarm bells? No, it didn't, because they were seen as being super safe. And in the context of Citi's, you know, the investment bank's balance sheet, they were not really that large. $30 billion sounds like a lot of money, but we're talking about a $1.5 trillion balance sheet or something like that.
And my recollection is that if you look at Citibank and not Citigroup, that the amount of capital Citibank had at that point in time, Tier 1 capital, was around $67 billion. So from the bank's perspective, to the extent this stuff is on the bank's balance sheet, that's a pretty big percentage of their Tier 1 capital, right?
The notional amount?
Yes.
I mean, if you could envision that the notional amount was all at risk. But, I mean, my assessment at the time is that these were very low risk and that the actual price in them, you know, turned out to be wrong, obviously. But, you know, I mean, that was our thinking at the time. The investment bank itself, I mean, even before you got to using up capital on losses, the investment bank was fairly, you know, was pretty profitable, and it was in a diverse line of businesses. It wasn't just this business producing the profit. It had, you know, an income stream from a diverse thing. So, I mean, you bring all that in to say whether this is actually a risky position. But in the end, you know, I didn't envision the risk that these positions ended up having.
Right. Now, the view that these were relatively safe investments, was that basically based on the rating that the rating agencies had given, or was there any independent poking underneath the hood by the Fed and actually looking at the deal-specific underlying assets going, you know, into the mortgage-backed securities and then looking at the underwriting criteria on the loans? Did you do that sort of a deep dive, or did you look at the structure and say, well, there's 30% subordination, it's got a AAA rating?
Yeah, I would first of all have to say that I personally did not rely on the rating. I'm a market risk person.
Uh-huh.
That rating is something that credit and analysts are much more familiar with. I don't even know what super senior means, to be honest with you. They just made that up in my mind. But my understanding of how these function, again, there was about 30%. So it actually got a little less. It may have been 20 to 30% across the various structures. But if you think through how actually these would play out, you would have to say to yourself, okay, the underlying mortgages here would have to see something along the line. If somebody else is going to absorb 20% of the losses, you'd have to see something along the lines of like 50% of all the mortgages default. And then the houses would have to be sold at a huge discount to where the loan value was, right? And since, you know, it was unimaginable to me to imagine 50% default rates in any sector, and that home prices would, you know, fall by 50%, you know, it was outside of anything that I had experienced, anything that I had known about. That's the sort of analysis that I actually would have gone through to say whether these, you know, were unsafe. Even what I could have envisioned. Now, I didn't actually do a formal analysis. This is the way I would have thought,
right.
Was thinking of these. You know, even if you constructed some sort of conceivable severe scenario, you'd still be looking at very minor losses on these things.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of the underlying mortgage-backed securities is that the triple B piece, which is, again, my understanding is the main component of the CDOs, is that the triple B piece is like the bottom 7% of mortgage-backed security tranche?
Yeah, it's a lower piece of those securities, and it varies at where those percentages
right,
at,
but in. Sort of ballparky.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So for that triple B piece to become worthless, doesn't that mortgage-backed security simply have to eat, like, say a 10% loss? Has to waterfall through the whole mortgage-backed security, and then that triple B piece becomes worthless? Isn't
well, they would all have to, I guess in very simple terms, they would all have to, first of all, in some of those structures, there's actually an equity piece below
right.
the triple B. So those lower pieces that made it up could experience losses, and they themselves would not experience losses.
But the equity piece was generally 2%, 3%?
I don't know what the figures are. It would have been small. I mean, look, the analysis was definitely wrong, and it basically because, like myself, many people could not envision that. They use historical experience to
right.
say that, we can't envision 10% housing price depreciation. We can't envision this level of defaults happening. And there was also it was also flawed because there was the belief that the portfolios were much more diversified than they ended up being. For several different reasons, not just geographical concentration, but if they're all subprime, then you're taking all low borrowers. There was a lot of fraud in there that I think very few people, particularly the structurers of these things, was not aware of. The analysis, history has shown the analysis was faulty, but that's really where the assumption is from a market risk perspective.
Right.
Comes in. I didn't rely on ratings for this because it's not really my thought process.
And they were using sort of historical analysis, but the main type of loan that was in the subprime market at that time was the so-called hybrid arm. Are you familiar with mm-hmm. what a hybrid arm is? And hybrid arms as sort of a big chunk of the mortgage market really didn't come on until, 2000 was sort of the when they basically got a little foothold, and then it was more like 2003 where you had a lot of the sort of non-depository lenders out there mostly, as well as some depositories that started doing these hybrid arms in large volume, which then fed into the MBS machine, which then got picked up. But I guess my question goes to sort of saying, well, it took like a Great Depression-style event, looking back, to do this. And, if these were 30-year fixed mortgages and it was just lower credit quality, I think I could understand that. But the fact that these mortgages were sort of completely untested in any downturn, do you think sort of everybody, the industry, the regulators, Congress, did everyone just sort of miss the boat on the risks that were inherent in these subprime mortgages that had this hybrid feature and the big payment shock that kicks in, and that's... It's not just that, housing prices had this big decline, but it was this particular product that proved to be so...
Yeah, I'm not a housing expert. I'm not a mortgage expert. Certainly, my personal opinion is what you just said is true. If you strip away all these structured finance, but somebody somehow funded all of these really low-quality loans, we would have had a massive blow-up anyway. This business, another flaw of this business and, a lot of other businesses is that it was moving so fast and it was migrating down the credit quality curve faster than a lot of people were actually picking it up. You know, if you go back to that, if you go back to that credit derivatives review that we were doing, and it in the ABS CDO book, obviously it says there that they were doing subprime. That was actually a small piece of the business at that time.
Right.
The rest of the business was all packaging bonds. So we were talking about, okay, you didn't get the corporate names in the structure correct, right? So, you know, in the meantime, this business had sort of slid down this credit quality curve. Investor demand certainly had a lot to do with it. They were packaging this because they were being asked for this. You know, standards got sloppy, obviously. Yeah, my analysis of it was incorrect. I didn't pick a lot of that up, that, you know, the credit quality had fallen that sharply.
Going on to page 25, there's a little rectangle, for lack of a better name, that says limit exceptions, and it shows in 2006 there were three increases in the super senior limits,
mm-hmm.
Eventually from $30 billion to $36
billion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what they were doing there is they were essentially approving higher limits. In technically, they were kidding themselves by what they called limit exceptions. There was a limit, and they were kidding themselves saying, we're going to temporarily approve these limits, but you need to really work on getting rid of these positions. They weren't, I can tell you that they still weren't overly concerned. They just didn't want these positions, you know, because they have to
right.
fund them and dispose of them. But, yeah, they were sort of fooling themselves into thinking that, you know, at some point in the future, we will be able to dispose of these.
Then turning to page 28, the second bullet point, program approval to offer leveraged super senior notes to investors to hedge desks' existing super senior exposure. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, actually what they were going to do is they were going to offer leverage to investors to buy these. So
are they going to finance?
Yeah, they were going to partly finance. You know, say if you finance 50% of it, you can capture double the spread risk.
Right.
You know, quite easy. You know, the super senior puts, the fact that these were put into a special purpose vehicle and asset-backed commercial paper was issued against us was one way of, you know, getting them off their balance sheet. This was just another mechanism that they thought would, you know, investors would be interested in. I don't think anything was actually ever executed there.
I haven't seen any documents, but all right. F-17 is a memo from you to the file dated January 9th, 2007. And it's Bates number 878-880.
Yes, as I said, we had quarterly meetings with the bank as part of our continuous monitoring. We did these, with the OCC.
Right.
By the date that you have here, it looks like this meeting probably went along with that presentation. So we were given that, but I also produced these minutes.
I'm interested in the last bullet point on the last page, which only has one bullet point, and it says, the bank continues to move towards consolidated reporting of risk across businesses. Maybe you want to look at the rest of the document to refresh your recollection.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misspoke. This is not. I thought you were pulling up this is a continuous monitoring meeting done with the OCC. What we used to do where we had these meetings is we'd sort of look at the different silos within the investment bank. So we'd talk to the fixed income. They're more or less doing like interest rate sort of derivatives and those types of things.
Right.
We talked to, you know, commodities business, whoever. The credit trading business was a separate silo. Okay. So when they gave us those presentations, we often, if we don't take any notes beyond that, those would count as our notes.
Right.
Okay. This would have been a meeting with the fixed income group focused strictly on interest rate products. Having said that, I don't recall exactly what I was looking at here. The bank has had traditional problems aggregating risks across businesses, but I can't say exactly what I was actually referring to there.
Sure. So in general, one of the things people have told us is that Citigroup is perhaps more decentralized than other comparably sized financial institutions, and that they also operate more in silos, as you said, that there is not perhaps as much communication at Citigroup as are among similar business lines within the entire bank holding company. Based on your experience in looking at other large financial institutions, would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, in certain ways there were parts. You know, I'm familiar with the investment banking piece because I always did capital markets.
Right.
In certain ways, there were businesses that were run almost as sort of standalone businesses within the investment bank. So I'm just going to make this up, but you know, the foreign exchange business, it really doesn't deal much with the other businesses, commodities, or any of those. Even though FX risk may exist in these other businesses, they were sort of standalone. Now, I just use that example. I don't remember if the foreign exchange business was run that way. But on top of that, the bank was saddled with all of these legacy systems from all their prior mergers. And to be quite honest with you, one of the assessments that we had made about this institution in past years was that, you know, they really didn't put the investments into some of the systems that should have been done. So they're patching together a lot of disparate systems. And that and possibly lack of effort on their part had hampered them from looking at risks that actually touch across different businesses within the investment bank, but also outside of the investment bank, right? Obviously, mortgage risk didn't just exist in the CDOs, it existed in other businesses. The banks had a lot of difficulty doing that. It's a big, sprawling organization. It's had a lot of difficulties in that area.
The next document, I'll mark F18. It's titled Citigroup Year in Review, Bates number 700-702, and it's dated January 11th, 2007. But as I think you've just said earlier, you'd only been on the CPC team a couple of weeks by then. Do you recall whether you had any input?
No, I don't. Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, again, there's several different efforts to sort of roll up everything that's done, you know, look at trends and, you know, large risks and things like that. I don't know if I document it specifically.
Okay. F19, these are meeting minutes between... Not really sure. I think it may be the OCC. Anyway, it's a Federal Reserve document, 730 and 731, and it's regarding meetings in December 07, sort of after the stuff has hit the fan?
I can probably point you to where this actually came from. This is the first cracks in the subprime and all the structured credit and all that. Really, it really started in July of 2007. By October, whatever was on the balance sheet was stuck there, blowing up, deteriorating, you know, in a very short amount of time. You couldn't price these instruments because certainly nobody wanted to buy them, so you had to put a valuation on it. The bank had put together a fairly large team, the bank, Citigroup, let me say. Shouldn't use that term carelessly. The Citigroup had put together a very large team to actually price these securities, and they were going to use a very fundamental model by looking all the way down into the individual securities and even at the loans to price it. The OCC did a lot of work up there. This is probably related to that. We had actually had some of our models folks go up there and look to see how they were actually pricing these. This was sort of not post-crisis, actually middle of the crisis. I think that's where you would actually find where those had come from. It doesn't say who actually wrote these. I know this gentleman right here was basically brought in to actually, you know, once everything is broken, how do we price these? Where do we put them? You know, how do we manage our way out of this?
And you're referring to Richard Stuckey.
Richard Stuckey and the subprime portfolio group.
Right.
It's a group to manage these distressed assets.
So what role did you play in that time period in, say, from October of 07 through January of 08 when... What did capital markets do?
Well, at that point, all we could really do was basically monitor, particularly from my position. All we could really do was monitor and report how bad the situation was getting. As I said, around the middle of July, the first cracks appeared. They appeared relatively quickly. And whatever, it was like musical chairs. Whatever you were holding at that point, there was little opportunity to hedge it or dispose of it or anything. Going into the subsequent months, and you know October was when they realized the big losses. It was just managing. It was just monitoring. You know what the losses were, how they were marking those positions. We had sent some of our financial modeling people in to meet with these folks. The OCC, I believe, had people on site for a couple of months looking very, very closely at that. At the same time, there were a lot of other problems cropping up. There was CIVs, there was auction rate securities, there was stuck leverage loan. I mean, you know, it was the entire financial system came to a grinding halt.
Right.
And just trying to just keep our senior management informed was a full-time job, which, there wasn't a lot of time to basically even write a lot of notes during that period. It was like making phone calls, passing information.
And you're at this point in time, you're actually on site at Citi?
The entire year of 2007, starting with that January, that report that we looked at produced by the bank,
right,
would have been the first time as a relationship person I'd really spoken to that business. And, you know, chronologically, I think you have a couple of my meeting minutes through the year.
Okay. And then the final document I'll ask you to look at is titled
F-20?
Yeah, F-20. Discussion Re-City. Begins with Bates number 732 and runs through 746. And it's dated January 2008. Do you know if you've Are you familiar with that document?
No, I'm not. You know, John was my boss.
Right.
This man had the most unfortunate timing of coming in there because Diane had gone on maternity leave, and the poor guy came in right as the crisis did. John produced a lot of material for our senior management, for the border, and all that kind of stuff. I'll leave that to him. Of course, at this time, we would have been doing another roll-up. You have a 2006 roll-up, we would be doing the 2007 roll-up. Because of the conditions at the bank and in the industry in general, there was probably a... I think he's talking about it here. They really want us to do this roll-up quick. You know, the whole fourth quarter of that year was getting information to, you know, senior management who had to make some, you know, had to make a lot of decisions. I'll leave it at that. You know,
okay.
It's John's. I probably had input to it, but I don't recall it.
Okay. How much interaction did you have, if any, with the board staff in Washington, D.C., or is that someone else here at the New York Bank that... Or did you have...
No, when I was on the CPC team, I mean, I had contact with them. Obviously, the crisis unfolded more. You know, the senior people at the board would have probably been more in contact with the senior people of the team, which would have been Diane and then John.
Right.
And, you know, some of the, you know, intermediate people would have actually been, you know, in contact with me, you know, depending on what they were looking at. There's, you know, the board has an analyst assigned to this, and we have an analyst, so they would have talked. So, yeah, I mean, we talked a lot as the crisis unfolded.
And what about your interaction with the SEC staff, if any?
My interaction with the SEC staff was actually pretty limited, pretty limited. I remember having conversations with them on various subjects. I don't recall having any conversations in this time period with them.
Did you ever have a desire to get information from any of the other related agencies, either the OCC or the SEC, as part of your workup? And not have those desires met? I mean, was there any point when you said, hey, we'd like to see such and such, you know, and they go, well, we can get it to you later? Were there any problems interagency?
No. I had a good relationship with my cohorts there. And, you know, they followed the letter of what we were supposed to do. Yeah, and we, you know, we reciprocated. I didn't have any problems with that.
Okay. Is there anything that you'd like to say that, you know, some gap I've left out in my little chain of documents here that you think is important to understanding sort of what happened at Citi and what could have been done, what should have been done either at the institution, here at the Federal Reserve, at the OCC, just based on your own knowledge and personal beliefs?
The one thing that I actually do want to say is that it's logical. It seems reasonable that, you know, you had taken some of that the exam work around the credit derivatives and make the leap that, you know, the infrastructure is broken, therefore, you know, they had these problems and the resulting losses. It's not really quite that simple. Actually, the issues that we found around the credit derivatives had to do with very difficult issues like pricing things and doing risk measurements, in a lot of cases on the very lowest pieces of the tranches. Even though those weaknesses were there, you know, we had a good understanding of what the bank was actually holding. You know, we pointed to that report and talked, we had a discussion with them. I don't know that those weaknesses led to, you know, a fundamental lack of knowledge around the big pieces that were sitting there, the ones that actually caused. And I don't think that those infrastructure issues were directly related to the bank itself missing the risk, if you understand what I mean.
Right,
the big
so you're
pieces
saying,
were identified, right? It may not have been the greatest analysis in the world, but they were identified. The bank had a lot of other weaknesses. They had admitted many of the weaknesses, you know, that they didn't aggregate their subprime, they didn't really identify the level of concentration in there. So I just want to make sure that you understand, yes, there were issues, and this is normal course of business. We do those types of exams. But those control issues there were not really directly related to them holding these big positions and ultimately having those losses.
Right. So to paraphrase that the infrastructure issues you identified were not the cause for them building a $31 or $36 billion super senior position. You identified some general problems in the business, some problems as to limits, maybe exacerbated the problem. If they'd kept the limits lower on the super senior positions, the problem might not have been as big. But clearly the underlying problem, be it $25 billion or $36 billion, was still going to be a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a handful of banks that got in trouble for doing this same thing, and I think in the end, their senior managers who knew this business was going on failed to make all the intellectual leaps to be able to say, you know, there is problems with this business, whereas others did. So I just wanted so that, you know, it wasn't like an obscure risk that you know, was hidden from anybody or anything like that. It was sort of they fundamentally...
It was the big elephant in the room.
They didn't assess it properly, and, you know, I mean, I was guilty and many others were guilty of the same, you know, faulty assessment.
Scott, do you have any? Well, it's a little after one. I want to thank you for your time. I know you guys have a lot to do these days as well, so we're very appreciative for your time and your candor, and that concludes this interview.
Okay.